Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, February 18, 2019. Internal displaced persons in Wau say it's not safe to return to their villages.
We are still afraid because opposition forces are still in the bush and the government soldiers are still deployed in the areas around our homes. How can we go home?
And Sudanese protesters marched on the streets of Washington over the weekend.
All we're asking for is acknowledgement, media exposure, and we're asking for the government to send a letter to the Sudanese people to release all political prisoners.
Yes.
Release all political prisoners, stop the use of tear gas, and stop using violent weapons.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some internal displaced persons in Wau's Agok and Masna areas say they are not ready to return to their villages because the security situation remains unstable. During a one-day forum organized by the UN mission in South Sudan last week, the IDPs said the government and the opposition forces pose major threats to their return. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Wau.
At least 5,000 IDPs are sheltering in Masna and Agok camps. Most of them fled violence from Greater Ju River area. Speaking in Arabic during the forum, IDP Pinyi Upio says his family fled the violence in Alur village in Kwarjina County 4 years ago and ended up in Masna IDP camps in Wau. Upio says he witnessed many atrocities while fleeing his village, which makes him think twice before making a decision to return home.
We are still afraid because opposition forces are still in the bush and the government soldiers are still deployed in the areas around our homes. How can we go home? This is what made us stuck here. Anytime they can fight again because they are still armed. Why should we go there then?
Opio says authorities must contain government and opposition forces and disarm cattle keepers in the area before they will agree to return to their villages. Anyaro Urayo Upio, a mother of two who fled her home in Odalelo area 3 years ago, says she has not seen her husband for 5 years. Speaking in her native Luo language, Urayo says armed men looted all her property, including livestock. She says she won't return home until she is certain the warring parties have stopped fighting.
Forces are still armed, and they are all over our village, and they are still telling us to go home. How are we going to survive there? This peace should be reflected not only in the town, but in all villages. The government should put all forces in the identified barracks. We are tired of staying in the camp.
Agok resident Clara Khamis cited armed cattle keepers and the random movement of cattle as the main cause of conflict in the area. Speaking in Arabic, Khamis is urging the government to disarm cattle keepers and order them not to graze their cattle on or near farmers' crops in order to prevent conflict between local communities.
Why should cattle be moving around destroying farms of our people here in Wau? Even if rebel and government forces are put in one place and cattle keepers are still moving with their livestock all over, we will still continue to fight and fight.
Abdulbagi Ibishomi, a civil affairs officer at UNMIS office in Wau, says even though roadblocks and instances of humanitarian aid workers being harassed are on the decline, insecurity remains a major threat to the voluntary return of IDPs. Ibishomi says it has been relative calm in the area since the peace deal was signed last year.
Initially, certain obstacles were identified. And what we have seen is that a lot of those obstacles have been addressed. But yet, we are still not seeing that massive return of IDPs to those areas. That shows that there are still some issues that need to be addressed.
Many IDPs have stressed the need to disarm cattle keepers as the main condition for their safe return home. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
More than 1,000 Sudanese protesters gathered in Washington, D.C. over the weekend to take part in demonstrations in the U.S. Capitol since the protests began across Sudan in mid-December. The Sudanese diaspora began the protest at the U.S. Capitol building on Saturday and marched several blocks towards the White House, carrying placards, some remembering the victims that died during the protest in Sudan and others demanding peace and justice. The protesters also chanted for the removal of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. Ayen Deng Dior was at the protest Saturday, where she spoke to some young people, some as young as 11 years old, who say they don't want to sit on the sidelines during this critical time in their country.
Okay, so we got your parents' permission for you guys to talk. The first thing, what's your name? How old are you?
Mohammed, and I'm 12 years old, actually.
12 years old? What's your name? How old are you?
My name is Ferris, and I'm 11 years old.
Okay, so you have a special message that you want to say. You sound very insistent on making sure that your voice is heard. What do you want to say?
I want to say to all the people that are living right now with homes to go to my country and help my lovely country and all the people that are getting hurt and like getting killed every single day. And I want them to get like the most help out of like everyone here. That's why we're here to help them.
Okay, you're 12 years old. Most 12 years old, they're at home right now playing video games. Why are you here?
I'm here to support my country and not just to play like games and stuff like that. I'm here to support my country and help them.
You want to say something?
What I would like to say is that you should be thankful if you have a home, you're eating, you're living, and that you're not in Sudan right now. I love Sudan. I've been there for about 2 years, actually, but then I came here. But it's just that Sudan, I just want to say, like, hopefully nothing bad, like, super bad happens. But right now it's, like, super, super bad because, okay, like, people are dying.
What's your name again?
Elza Elzen.
How old are you?
18. Honestly, it's a really sad feeling because when you think about it, that could be me right now. I could be living there. My schools could be getting bombed. My family could be getting shot. It's really sad and needs to be stopped right now. I want Donald Trump to speak to the Sudanese embassy and try to help them as much as they can because America preaches about human rights and America wants to help people. So where are they now when the people are getting hurt?
How old are you again and what's your name?
21 and my name is Zamzam Elzan. All we're asking for is acknowledgement, media exposure, and we're asking for the government to send a letter to the Sudanese people to release all political prisoners.
Yes.
Release all political prisoners, stop the use of tear gas, and stop using violent weapons on these innocent people. They have nothing to fight for but their own hands, but they are dying at the hands of us. We are here representing our country, Sudan, because right now we can be Sudan living like them, but we are here. The least we can have is a representation of democracy from the American government. That is all. Thank you.
What's your name?
Ikhlas Ahmed.
And then how old are you?
I am 26 years old. This means a lot. This protest has started 2 months ago and is still ongoing because, as Rima said, it's led by the youth in Sudan and in the diaspora because this is our future. We're fighting for our parents and our grandparents. This is the
And your children.
And our children, of course, but for most definitely, we want to go back home one day because this is our home.
I think this revolution is belonging to the youth. This is the revolution of the youth. We've waited for 30 years, and unfortunately, nothing has happened. So this is our future. So we are the ones who are carrying this revolution, and we are the ones who are making it our responsibility, because this is for our children's generation. This is for our generation.
That was Ayen Deng Dior speaking with Sudanese diaspora who gathered here in Washington, D.C. on Saturday to draw attention to the plight of the protesters in Sudan. The protest began December 19 when the government increased the price of bread 3 times. The demonstrations have since spread into wider calls for President Bashir to step down. Sudan government says 31 people died in the protest-related violence since December, but Human Rights Watch puts the death toll to 51. A unique project is making strides in breaking down community resistance towards international efforts to contain the spread of the deadly Ebola virus in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. The International Federation of Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies has teamed up with the U.S.-based Center for Disease Control to collect, analyze, and implement new strategies in real time to tackle the major concerns of people faced with this dreaded disease. Lisa Schlein has the story for VOA from Geneva.
Latest World Health Organization figures put the number of Ebola cases at 829, including 521 deaths. Officials say containing the spread of this deadly virus will depend largely upon getting communities to cooperate with healthcare workers. This involves gaining their trust by overcoming the fears and misinformation that exist in Ebola-affected communities. Red Cross volunteers mainly come from the communities in which they work and understand their cultures and traditions. Health workers say getting feedback on Ebola from communities in conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces is critical in tackling this crisis. IFRC Community Engagement Senior Advisor Ombretta Baggio says information gathered from surveys is problematic. So she tells VOA, Red Cross volunteers no longer prompt people to answer a list of survey questions. Now, she says, they listen.
We have conversation with them around their concerns around Ebola, what they want to know from us around Ebola, so the questions they have, the beliefs, the systems that they have, the rumors that they're listening in their communities. And during these conversations, the volunteers share information around issues that are of concern for the communities.
Baggio says the Red Cross has just finished an analysis of the data collected from Beni, where the Ebola outbreak was first detected in August. By listening, she says Red Cross volunteers have learned about the fears and concerns people have about the treatment centers where infected people are isolated from their families. After the data is coded and categorized, she says it is shared with the Centers for Disease Control.
CDC does the quality assurance of the data, and they interpret this data in a way that is user-friendly for the response partners. This analysis helps our volunteers understand what are the most prominent questions that in that space of time communities are asking.
Traditional burial practices play a key role in the spread of Ebola. Christine Prue, a health scientist with the CDC, leads the project. She says providing safe and dignified burial services is one of the major pillars and interventions in reducing the spread of the disease.
So we analyzed all that data and sent the reports back to Red Cross and saying, is there a way for family members to be, a safe way for family members to be involved? Their teams on the ground figure it out. So our analysis of the information they provided and our question saying, can you do things differently to bury them in a way that could include family members was totally their action on our information. So they've changed their processes to allow community members to participate in a safe way.
Prue says there's been a shift in people's confidence around burials. But as one problem is solved, she tells VOA, others arise. She says the Red Cross will have to adapt its programs to meet these different needs.
I do think, and generally, the pattern that they have set is really good, but I don't think we can ever be satisfied that one way is going to be the only way, which actually reinforces the need for these kinds of feedback systems. Because every community is going to experience threat. Every community is going to either invite or involve people, outsiders, insiders, in different ways.
The World Health Organization cites Katwa and Butembo as the remaining major health zones of concern. It says community mistrust, especially in Katwa, is high. Consequently, it says people are reluctant to report suspected cases and bring infected people in for early treatment. Red Cross advisor Baggio says an additional problem is health workers are unable to access several areas in Katwa because of the conflict. However, she says the lessons learned from the project's analysis will be implemented in areas where they can work. She says volunteers will no longer deal with Ebola in a general way. Instead, she says, they will focus on and respond to the precise concerns articulated by the communities in Katwa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Cameroon faces challenges with rehabilitating former Boko Haram soldiers. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how does your community express its hospitality?
My community, because I'm from Eastern Equatoria, and my tribe is Peri tribe. And for example, once a visitor comes at home, and if a female is there, she has to greet and kneels down. She has to bring water.
When the person moves in the community, we all go and we go and visit the person and get to find out more about the person and welcoming the person to the community.
I think they watch out for people. When you move in newly in the area, people come and say hello.
In my community, they express hospitality in terms of receiving guests, treating them good, providing them an accommodation, shelter, food and drinks.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. In Cameroon, many Boko Haram fighters have surrendered in recent months, but Cameroon lacks facilities to rehabilitate them. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Mora on the Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria.
These are soldiers of the multinational joint task force fighting the Boko Haram insurgency, singing at their base in Mora on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria as they train for eventual operations against the terrorist group. At the same time, there are 87 Boko Haram fighters in custody. The fighters were captured a year ago when they decided to lay down their weapons and be pardoned and rehabilitated, as the government of Cameroon had promised. Governor Mijiyawa Bakari of Cameroon's far north region says the former fighters will remain at the base until a rehabilitation center is constructed for them.
Site 13 hectares avait été choisi. La procédure d'obtention du titre foncier en cours.
He says they have acquired a 13-hectare land and are waiting for the central government in Yaoundé to provide funds so that they can develop it. He says Boko Haram fighters that are still reluctant to come out of the bushes of fear that they may be arrested by the Cameroon military and detained should have confidence in the government. He says anyone who comes back will be socially and economically reintegrated and treated as Cameroonians who were simply deceived but have realized that they were wrong and are returning to develop their country. In December, Cameroon created a committee to disarm and reintegrate separatist fighters in the English-speaking regions and Boko Haram terrorists who put down their weapons. The centers for the separatists have been created in the towns of Bamenda and Boya. The centers for ex-Boko Haram fighters are yet to be built. That may be why some former Boko Haram fighters are bypassing the government program altogether. Johem Kawamza, a 37-year-old former Boko Haram fighter, waters his maize farm here in Mora. He escaped from Nigeria in December 2017 and refused to go to the official rehabilitation center, choosing instead to reunite with his family. He says he did not trust the government's rehabilitation program. He says, unlike some of his peers who are being kept as prisoners in military camps, he has rebuilt his life with the aid of a United Nations and government-backed program that trained him and gave him fertilizers and maize to grow.
Moi, j'ai déjà stocké le maïs. Pour moi, la fin cette année.
He says he and his family will no longer be hungry this year, as he has stocked enough maize and groundnuts to keep them going. He says last year he was treated as an outcast until some white humanitarian workers came, trained them, and gave them maize to plant and take care of their families. He says it is his wish to use the knowledge he got from the UN program to empower people who joined or were kidnapped by Boko Haram. Cameroon's government has said it wants to help former fighters like Kawamza, but first wants to ensure they have definitely broken with Boko Haram before giving them assistance and training to earn a living. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
From Cameroon, we move to Kenya, where Kenya has set conditions for the resolution of a maritime diplomatic row that heightened over the weekend, leading to Kenya recalling its ambassador to Somalia and ordering Somalia's envoy out of Kenya. This came after Kenya accused Somalia of auctioning off oil and gas blocks that Kenya says are in its territorial waters. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Somalia has refuted the Kenyan allegations.
Kenya has been at the forefront in East Africa to ensure peace in the neighboring countries, including offering humanitarian services to displaced people, especially those from Somalia. But on Saturday, things fell apart between the two countries when Kenya recalled its envoy to Somalia, Ambassador Lucas Tumbo, and asked Somalia to immediately withdraw its Ambassador Mahmoud Ahmed Noor from Kenya. The diplomatic tit-for-tat followed an allegation by Kenya that Somalia was auctioning off oil and gas blocks in its territory. Addressing the media, Kenya's Foreign Affairs Principal Secretary Macharia Kamau said the alleged auctioning took place on the 7th of February 2019 in London, United Kingdom.
The government of Kenya cannot and will not stand by as its demarches are ignored and its territorial integrity is infringed upon, and its sovereign resources are carved out and shared out by an ungracious and unbrotherly neighbor acting to satisfy the greed of commercial interests resident in foreign lands. Kenya's magnanimity towards its neighbors must never be taken for granted.
Many Kenyan soldiers have been killed in Somalia since their country's involvement with Somalia in 2011. Macharia says Somalia's decision to auction off oil and gas blocks in Kenyan territory was uncalled for.
Kenya is prepared and ready to defend its territorial integrity at any cost and considers all those directly or indirectly, whether Kenyan or non-Kenyan, in encroachment of Kenya's territory as enemies of the state and as adversaries of the people of Kenya. It is tragic and most regretful that the government of Somalia has chosen to take this action against a people and a state that has stood by the Somali people through incredible humanitarian and political hardships.
Kenya's sea boundary dispute with Somalia has been boiling for years. In 2014, Somalia sued Kenya at the International Court of Justice, ICJ, asking for a proper determination of the sea border between the two countries. The case is still pending, but ICJ judges allowed the case to go to full hearing despite Kenya's opposition to have alternative dispute resolution. Kamau says the federal government of Somalia does not embrace political maturity and diplomatic stand of a modern government.
By carelessly ignoring the internationally accepted norms of boundary disputes resolution and or political and diplomatic disagreements, the federal government of Somalia has sadly demonstrated that it has not yet attained and embraced the political maturity and diplomatic stance of a normal, well-adjusted and properly functioning modern government.
However, in a letter to Kenyan government, Somalia's Foreign Affairs Ministry has dismissed claims that it auctioned the oil and gas blocks in Kenyan territory. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Some internally displaced persons in Wau's Agok and Masna areas say they will not return to their villages until the security situation has improved. Last week, during a one-day forum organized by UNMISS and the Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, or CEPO, says IDPs and government opposition forces pose a major threat to their return. At least 5,000 IDPs are known to be sheltering in the Masna and Agok camps. IDP Piney Upio says he and his family fled fighting in Alur village in Kwarjina County some 4 years ago and ended up in Wau's Masna IDP camp. Upio says he witnessed many atrocities while fleeing his village. He says authorities must canton both government and opposition forces and disarm cattle keepers in the area before he and others will agree to return to their villages in Wau. More than 1,000 Sudanese diaspora protesters gathered here in Washington, D.C. on Saturday in a mass demonstration over the Bashir administration and the handling of protesters in Sudan. The protests began at the U.S. Capitol, and then demonstrators marched towards the White House. They carried signs, some remembering the victims that have died during the protests, while others demanded peace and justice. Many chanted for the removal of Sudan President Omar al-Bashir. Yesterday, a Sudanese fruit vendor died in Khartoum from inhaling tear gas fired at protesters. Medics and the vendor's family said the 62-year-old Bahari resident died in the hospital after choking on tear gas, which was fired at protesters quickly after they took to the streets. Demonstrations that began on December 19th have evolved into calls for President Bashir to step down. Sudan's government says 31 people have died in protest-related violence so far since the protests broke out in December, but the group Human Rights Watch puts the death toll closer to 50. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Hasada Mako by Isaka Number 1. Isaka Number 1. We have been listening to Isaka Number 1 with that song, Hasada Mako. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nasi